But I'm going to begin by acknowledging the investigative team and to state that this is a project that comes out of an NIAAA-funded clinical trial, but in order to keep myself out of trouble, is not funded by it, but is an extra study we undertook using that emerged out of some of our partial data. And I would like to acknowledge Dr. Carol North, who's my collaborator for the last 20-plus years, Robert Devereaux of UT Southwest Clinical Psychology Department, Barry Hong from Washington University in St. Louis, and Mamta Jain from University of Texas Southwest. These numbers are probably not unfamiliar to you, this information. Hepatitis C rates of about 3.3 million new cases, 3.3 million cases with about 16,000 new cases each year. In spite of what, from a medical perspective, is a pretty effective set of medical treatments, a surprisingly small proportion of hepatitis C patients actually achieve a sustained virologic response. One of the reasons in the literature that's most often suggested are difficulty in accessing and maintaining treatment. Unfortunately, if you look at the small but relatively well-done literature, what one finds is that is almost exclusively barriers are identified by asking physicians and other providers about the difficulties. In other physical and mental health conditions, it has been found that when you ask the people who are receiving the service what the barriers are, they often differ substantially from what the physicians and other providers say. So what we thought we would do is address this weakness in the hepatitis C treatment barrier literature by conducting focus groups asking about barriers to care. So what we have are 9 focus groups, 4 of which are conducted with mono-infected hepatitis C patients and 5 with co-infected hepatitis C HIV. These are recruited from local clinics in a publicly funded safety net healthcare network. And I should mention, when you say that, this is, by the way, in Dallas, Texas, where these groups were being conducted. The public clinics are, generally speaking, populations that either lack insurance or have other financial challenges. So when we come to talk about generalizability and what we learned, you should keep that in mind. Just a little bit to look at the sample. Our sample was approximately 2/3 male. It was primarily African American with a small proportion of Hispanic. It is not quite representative of the Dallas metropolitan area, somewhat underrepresenting Latino populations and overrepresenting African American. The mean age is approximately 50 years. I'm never sure when I say 50 years whether to say that's a mature or a younger population. Before this year, I would have said a mature population. After this year, now it's a younger population. Okay, there are not too many 50-year-olds in the audience, obviously. Because it's a qualitative, we did not collect data on how the infection was transmitted, nor do we know information except through the qualitative data, which I'll present, on what their treatment past is. So the focus groups are co-facilitated by a psychiatrist, Dr. North, and a physician, mostly Dr. Jane, who specializes in hepatitis C. We used a very broad questioning route. Basically, we explained what the study was about, told them to tell us what they experienced, and then got out of the way. So this is a very open approach. We're looking to get description of the phenomena rather than testing a priori categories. One of the things to note is that although qualitative focus groups are really clear to the researchers, for a population that is being asked about barriers to care, the distinction between a research group and a here's a chance to ask a doctor questions about my medical condition and treatment options was less clear. And as you'll see, we chose a strategy after our first group of briefly answering questions and then moving back to the discussion. The groups are audio taped and broken into individual passages. A passage is a single statement made by a single person. Across the nine groups, there were 936 passages. Comments by facilitators were not counted as passages. We had an initial coding process where a naive rater read through the data and the passages and created an initial set of categories. Two independent raters, different from the naive rater, then coded passages into the categories, allowing the categories to be coded multiple times. So if you're obsessive compulsive and want to add up the numbers, they will add up to more than 936. Then using this, we calculated an inter-rater reliability for coded items. So if an item was coded in a category, it was examined to see if the other coder put the same item in the same category. Differences were resolved through a consensus process by the team. And since our initial inter-rater reliability yielded kappas with a mean of 0.82 and a range from 0.66 to 1.0, rather than redefine and continue the coding, we then move to analysis. What we ended up with were initially 11 content categories, of which three were eliminated either because they were one individual in one group or a small enough percentage of groups so that we felt that they were not really generalizable categories but represented individual interests. During the interpretation phase, we realized that our eight categories conceptually really fell into four themes. So we collapsed the categories into the themes, and I'll be talking about the themes rather than the categories. I want to make sure people are clear on that, otherwise the rest of the talk will make absolutely no sense. The categories are issues around treatment, information about hepatitis C, social factors, and coping mechanisms. Here's just a little sample. I always worry as a qualitative researcher putting percentages up there. For those of you who are not familiar with qualitative research, please don't get too excited by these percentages. They tell you the number of passages, not the meaning, the length, or the importance. So they're really just a way to kind of get a hold of what the categories are and how much conversation was about. When I presented this at a departmental meeting, we had a long discussion where a quantitative person insisted that we should do t-tests. And I'd like to, as a qualitative and mixed researcher, say, please, that's not what these numbers mean. So if you look at our content categories, they're listed at the bottom. I'm colorblind, so I didn't realize this wasn't in color until yesterday. If you look at the shade, that will tell you how the categories were collapsed. Some of the themes are a single category, and some of the themes are multiple categories. So let's look at our themes. What I have up here are three quotes that are representative of the primary focus of the treatment issues. And what you see is that in terms of what they're focused on, the first one focuses on a lack of feeling communicated with. that they're not telling them what they're doing. The second is a combination of perceived lack of access both to doctors and to time from any providers. Thank you. And the third is about communications around issues of the impact of treatment. This theme, is mostly where the questions about hepatitis C treatment came from. And you can see that the issue is around receiving information, that is, what they're being told by the doctors. And as you dig into this, what you find is that it's less about the doctor giving them information and more about the doctor giving them information that they can actually use and understand. And we'll come back to this, but note that when the doctors report that they are giving information to the hepatitis C and HIV patients, what you see in this theme, a very strong response is, yes, they are telling me, but no, I don't understand. Another piece, and I've been to three different sessions today about stigma, so it's kind of on my brain, is the idea about both the positive and negative aspects of social aspects of living with both hepatitis C and HIV. And one of the interesting things that we found was that in terms of talking about negative social factors and responses that were stereotype, that it was more frequently the hepatitis C that was described as stigmatizing and less often the HIV. And that what we found in the statements was that HIV is relatively well understood by social network, and hepatitis C is a much scarier thing. And if you've been in the HIV or hepatitis C research area for a while, what we saw reminded us of what the stigma was around HIV 10 years ago. It's now looking more like the hepatitis C. Let me caveat, of course, this is qualitative, so I'm not stating that as a general finding. I'm stating that as a finding in our groups. Coping mechanisms in terms of what we found was actually both was generally positive in nature, that people described ways in which they coped. In other disease and mental health areas, they talk about these as resiliency factors. And there was a very strong theme of that going through, very strong, that's a very poor word, a very strong focus on that going through the theme. So what we found that in general was we found that there was a lot of report of frustration with the doctor-patient relationship. The limited contact, which I'm sure is no surprise, as that is in the literature, but the point I made earlier about the doctors using medical jargon and the patients not understanding it. There's also a great deal of confusion and frustration about the actual information about hepatitis C. That is, many of the people in the focus group said, I didn't get clear message and I'm not sure I understand what the illness is. I talked about stigma and personal resilience and determination. This has implications for clinical practice. And really what it came down to was our feeling from these focus groups was that there needs to be more attention paid primarily in the systems in which the person with hepatitis C and or HIV deals with the system, some of which focuses on training the provider to communicate with the patient, development of materials, patient education, and family-level interventions. Thank you.